Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 6th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Ethan Genter. Good morning, Ethan.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for being here. Joining us later will be WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Mary Ann Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. We'll check in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll hear from our State House reporter Mike Dean. We'll speak with WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Ethan, this week the Cape Cod Times finally got information from the Coast Guard about a major accident more than 2 years ago. This was the Steamship Authority Fast Ferry running into the Hyannis Harbor breakwater and not just clipping it, but going right up onto the rocks. More than a dozen people injured. Start off by telling us what these documents were.
Yeah, so we had put in a public records request to the Coast Guard back in May, I believe, and it finally came through at the end of last month. But so we requested basically everything that had to do with the IANO, which is the steamship's lone fast ferry, and the crash into the breakwater in 2017. So we there was subpoenas for medical records, summaries of interviews with the captain and the pilot, the two officers who were on the bridge that evening, inspections, phone records, there was pictures, you name it. There was quite a few. There was, I think, hundreds and hundreds of pages. There was weather data from that evening.
Well, one of the things that comes out from these documents is a sort of a narrative of what happened that night. Walk us through now what our understanding is of what happened with the ferry that night.
Yeah, so this was the last trip of the night back from Nantucket to Hyannis on the ferry. So that leaves right around 8:45. So that night it was a little windy. We're talking like 30 knot winds.
This is June. This is June 16th, 2017.
Correct. Just,
yep.
And there was spots of rain, some patchy fog here and there. And the Coast Guard basically said it's kind of on the high end range of what the IANO can comfortably handle. On the bridge that night, there was Captain Carl Ritter and Thomas Manley was the pilot. Those two, they're both pretty seasoned officers, although Mr. Manley was retired at this time, and he was brought back in. There was a short of a pilot and officers, basically, at that time. So they set sail from Nantucket, and everything goes pretty smoothly up until about 15 minutes before they're supposed to get to Hyannis Harbor and kind of pull up to the dock, which at one point, every time you pass a buoy along the route, you kind of log it, and they have this kind of log on the bridge. And so they were looking for one buoy, couldn't find it because of the weather. And so the captain told the pilot to use the IANO spotlight to try and find it. Mr. Manley, who had a 10-month absence since he was last on the boat, had last worked on the IANO, couldn't turn on the spotlight, which is kind of where things start to really go wrong. So the captain spends a little time helping the pilot, about 15 seconds, which is kind of boggling that a lot of this kind of fell apart in only 15 seconds. So the captain helps the pilot work the spotlight. Eventually, they get it working, and then the captain goes back to the radar, and he sees kind of three points on the radar, which he believes are the three upcoming buoys that kind of lead right into the harbor. It turned out that one was the light at the things he was looking at on the radar. One was the light at the end of the breakwater, and then the other two were moored sailboats. And then right around 9:35, the captain sees the breakwater, and about cruising speed, which is about 30 knots, they go right up onto the breakwater, It's kind of miraculous that more people didn't get hurt.
So you say he looked away for about 15 seconds to help get this spotlight turned on. 15 seconds going at 30 knots. You can imagine that's actually, they're covering a fair amount of water in that time. Tell us about the crash itself. Then they impact the breakwater. A number of people injured here and significant damage.
Yeah, there's about 15 people were hurt. A few people ended up having to get airlifted off. There was no life-threatening injuries at the end of the day. One of the worst injuries on the boat was someone who was on one of the stairwells when it happened. So you can imagine they went flying, basically, after kind of. So this hits dead on right under the breakwater. And if you ever take the ferry from Hyannis to Nantucket, you can still, if it's a clear day, you can still see the two holes that are basically in the breakwater. The boat sustained about $350,000 in damage. It was quite all three holes were damaged. And the Iana was out for I think at least a month off the top of my head here.
So tell us about some of the recommendations that the Coast Guard, what they came out of this with. They have a couple of recommendations, but they're not, it's a little bit complicated.
Yeah. So whenever there's an incident like this, it kind of falls into a few different categories. But the Coast Guard, and during these investigations, if the Coast Guard sees a flaw in Coast Guard regulations or kind of how things work, they can make these things, and they're called safety recommendations. And in this, there was two of them. And these, this isn't just for the Steamship Authority. This would be something that would be basically affecting top to bottom anything the Coast Guard touches. So that was one of the reasons why we were told that this investigation took so long to come out, was because those kind of had to work their way, and it ended up working its way all the way to the Commandant, which is the highest ranking in the Coast Guard.
Let me just jump in and say that the investigation hasn't really come out. You just FOIA'd these documents to come out. Is that right? It's not like the Coast Guard has produced a report.
There was a couple drips and drabs earlier this year that came out, just like the safety recommendations came out, and then there were some pieces of the investigation in there. This is the first time that I've seen it kind of all compiled in one place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it wasn't, and there was another place. It was also slightly released. But so the first recommendation that investigators from the Coast Guard made was they wanted annual verification of the vessel's operation manual. So right now the Coast Guard only examines manuals, and so the Coast Guard investigators were saying there were some issues, there were some gaps in between the owner's manual and the operations manual, and some things that the Coast Guard has updated since then. Like you said, it does get a little wonky in this part of the story, but the commandant, who has to kind of stamp off these recommendations, did not totally stamp off on this one. And there was another one he also didn't totally stamp off on, which was the kind of requiring, they're called safety management systems, which are basically kind of policies to kind of downplay risk management, kind of make sure things don't go wrong, basically. The Steamship Authority is in the process of implementing kind of a system at the moment, which came out of a massive review of their operations last year, I believe it was.
And there's still some outstanding claims around this crash.
Yes. So this was brought into federal court. It was kind of not the way most lawsuits come into play. So the Steamship Authority filed basically trying to limit liability or exonerate themselves of liability in this incident. And then people had to file claims against that that original filing that the Steamship Authority made. So it wasn't people filing a lawsuit against the Steamship Authority originally. It was kind of, so it's kind of backwards. So right now there's been just about $1 million in settlements over, I think it's around 15 or 16 people have made claims. Most have settled. I think 9 have settled so far, 9 plaintiffs in this case. It's just settlements have totaled just around $1 million.
And the government wants some money back for repairing the breakwater.
Yeah, so the breakwater, it's kind of weird. Part of it is state-owned and part of it's federally owned. So part of it's overseen by the Corps of Engineers. So they were looking for money to patch up those two big gashes in it.
Let's set that aside for a moment and move on. A stalemate at the State House is putting a significant chunk of local funding in jeopardy. This has to do with a lot of money that the state already has in hand but needs to decide about how it will be distributed. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is funding, and this is not just the Cape either. It kind of is very far-reaching, but it's in the supplemental budget. And so right now it needs to go through conference committees, and there's been kind of a stalemate on scheduling those. And the comptroller has basically said, you guys need to come to an agreement by December 11th or else we're closing the books and this money's kind of gone off the table. Some of the big things for the Cape in there, there was $3 million in for disaster relief for Cape towns when we got hit by 3 tornadoes in July. There was $195,000 to kind of mitigate shark presence, great whites. $200,000 for housing and homeless prevention on the vineyard, $100,000 for cybersecurity for Cape Cod Community College, $20,000 for a squid study over on Nantucket. Another big one is I think there was $30 million for PFAS, which has been a big issue in this area.
And that's for kind of a statewide effort on that PFAS testing. Our delegation is a State House delegation coming out here saying that these monies are critical to the region.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has been seen as a way to kind of keep towns financially afloat. A lot of people, especially the disaster aid, the PFAS is another big one. That's going to be a big ticket item that a lot of towns, not just on the Cape either, are going to have to deal with. So the Cape delegation is not very happy over this. Unfortunately, I think these conferences are confidential, so it's kind of hard to see why the scheduling isn't exactly happening.
So in the end, the House and the Senate kind of have different versions of this bill to how to allocate these supplemental spending money. And then they go into confidential negotiations to reconcile their different versions. And that's where this thing is hung up. So even members of the Cape delegation here are on the outside of those confidential discussions and wondering what's going to happen. There's also a deadline here that they're trying to work against.
Yeah, it was December 11th. They were basically told to get their act together or else they're going to close the books, and then these funds would kind of come out of a rainy day fund. But Tim Whalen, our state representative from Brewster, was worried kind of how that looks when you start to get to the rating agencies and for credit. It's kind of, we have the money here, but we're dipping into a rainy day fund seemingly just because we can't schedule things.
So that
doesn't look great.
Right. And in the end, the holdup with this big supplemental bill has nothing to do with the Cape spending items in it. It has, in fact, people aren't really sure what's holding it up right now. But it's not Cape specific in that way. So our delegation.
This is the whole state. I mean, and you have $50 million for MBTA, which you would think they would want to kind of get that cooking.
But they do have a deadline Wednesday coming up. We'll see what happens there. And we'll hear more on this later in the program from our State House reporter, Mike Dean. Ethan, let me ask you about a new Coast Guard report that points to millions of pounds of illegally caught fish by commercial fishermen. And this is all separate from the illegal fishing that was done by the boats owned by Carlos Rafael out of New Bedford, who was known as the Codfather. Tell us about this report.
Yeah, so earlier this week out in Rhode Island, the New England Fishery Management Council held a meeting and where this Coast Guard report came out. A lot of Coast Guard reports, apparently. But basically, this Coast Guard investigation looked at data collected from fishermen, from federal observers on vessels, and reported landings by dealers, and it kind of cross-referenced them with fishery research and information from boarding vessels. And it kind of looked at the differences and said fishermen, some fishermen are saying they're catching X amount of fish in one area where we either know there's not a lot of, kind of to science, we know there's either not a lot of fish there. So it's kind of, it was kind of an interesting cross-reference here and trying to figure out. And so this is another thing that gets kind of wonky about quotas in certain areas for certain fishermen. And the Coast Guard believes that there's quite a bit of illegal fishing trips, I think, over some of the 350 trips.
And this is going back to 2011 to 2015. And as this information has been assembled essentially out of data, as you're saying here, other fishermen are responding to this, saying that it really impacts the whole fishery, and the guys who've been playing by the rules in the end are really coming out short here.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of thinking they're the ones that are going to have to pay the toll for this.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're getting tighter restrictions, while the people who are flouting the law don't seem to mind. And, I mean, Carlos Rafael really comes to mind because they say a lot of people kind of, this is kind of an open secret, kind of he was been operating that way for so long. And why didn't people crack down harder on him?
Fishermen hoping that at least one of the things that comes out of this analysis of data is some ways to improve the system to eliminate some of the ways that this cheating has happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, some people were kind of looking at the brighter side. And it is kind of a way of showing kind of we're not going to be tolerating this going forward. It's going to be interesting, but it could be a signal that things are, loopholes are going to try to be closed. And things are going to be a little tighter going forward.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. Speaking with us from the Cape Cod Times, Ethan Genter. Ethan, thanks for joining us this morning.
Absolutely, Steve. Thanks for having me.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. A study out this week identified air contamination around New Bedford Harbor as a risk to residents there. With us to talk about the study and what it means is WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Steve.
Tell us, who did this study and what it found?
Sure. So the study was done by Boston University's School of Public Health. There's been a team of researchers there that have been studying the harbor and its contamination since about 2015. This particular study focused on the effects that PCBs in the air would have on essentially, it looked at any adverse health effects. That has just not been studied very much right now.
People have known that these PCBs were present in the harbor for a long time now. But this study, looking at airborne PCBs, this is something new?
Yeah. So the study, this is actually a follow-up on a study that they released in 2017 that even talked about the fact that PCBs could be transferred from sediment in the harbor, which is where they've been measured, into the air. That was a surprise to everybody back in 2017 that they could even make that barrier transfer. And then this study in particular looked at what types of health effects could come from long-lasting inhalation of PCBs.
These PCBs are known carcinogens. Fill in a little bit of the backstory here. The harbor is a Superfund site. It's been the subject of a long cleanup effort. Where did the pollutants come from, and where is the effort right now?
Sure, yeah. So the harbor has been a Superfund site designated by the EPA since 1983. The soil there became contaminated from electrical device production facilities around the harbor. They discharged their wastewater into that water, and that is how we got PCBs that have settled in the sediment. The harbor right now is in its final stages of cleanup, so the state says. Recently, the state designated about $24 million to do some final dredging of the site and make it suitable for the offshore wind industry. So hopefully, within the next couple of years, I suppose people hope that the PCBs will fully be out of the sediment, though unfortunately they are in the air.
So this study's indicating that people within about a half mile of the harbor are at risk for some of these hormones ozone-level disruptions because of these airborne PCBs. What happens with this information now?
So this is all kind of breaking new ground. You know, it's never been studied before that PCBs could even cause thyroid hormone disruption or put you at a higher risk for diabetes or having infants with low birth rate. The EPA has no specified limit on what level of PCB ingestion is safe. And so the hope is airborne-wise, they do know that if you're eating PCBs directly out of sediment or through fish, that
or
obviously
coming into contact with,
that obviously that would be cancerous, but they've never studied airborne PCB inhalation. And so there's hope that this study can kind of inform those levels in the future. But unfortunately, there is no way for residents to really prevent themselves from breathing it in if you live within that half-mile radius.
That is WCAI Sarah Mises-Tan. Sarah, thanks for joining us this
morning.
Thanks
so much, Steve.
We are headed toward the winter holidays, but there is excitement building in Chatham for the big summer holiday, Independence Day. With us to tell us why this coming one will be a big deal is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Steve.
Tim, you have some explosive news. Can I say that?
I guess you could, yeah. Fireworks are going to be returning to Chatham for Independence Day this year. Now, it's the first time in 45 years that Chatham will have had a town-sponsored or a public Independence Day fireworks display. They were held at Veterans Field here from the 50s until 1975, when the fire chief at the time called them off because he said they were just too dangerous in that location. Which, as if people don't know, that's the downtown baseball park where the Chatham A's play. But the display at the park returned in 2012 as part of the first night celebration, and now it's going to be coming back for the town's 4th of July festivities. Now, this summer display is being brought back by a group of sponsors, which includes the Chatham Athletic Association, the Chatham Anglers Organization, Chatham Bars Inn, the Chamber of Commerce, and a few others. It all sort of got started when CBI manager Gary Thulander was talking with the board president of the Chatham A's, Steve West, about what the two groups could be doing together more closely. They do a lot of cooperative activities together. The Inn is a big sponsor of the team. And Thulander said he had been considering trying to find a location for a fireworks display on July 4th. And West, who had been involved with First Night when they began doing it at Veterans Field, said, you know, how about doing them there? It's the perfect place. Initially, they wanted to do the fireworks on July 4th, but there's a logistical problem with actually doing them on the July 4th holiday because the police coverage that's needed for the town's big Independence Day parade, as well as evening fireworks that are held on Pleasant Bay, sponsored by Wequosset Inn, those draw a lot of people along Chatham roads, and that requires some police presence. Those two events make it really hard, the police department said, to squeeze in another a big fireworks event right in the center of town. So what the organizers have decided to do is that the fireworks display will kick off the town's Independence Day holiday this year on Thursday, July 2nd. And on Friday is the first Chatham band concert, and then there's the big parade on July 4th. So that's going to be the sequence of events this year. Hopefully in the future they'd like to move the fireworks closer to the actual Independence Day. But this is sort of a trial this year, and they're still looking for a few approvals from town boards, but everybody seems to be on board with this event.
Hey, also in the Chronicle this week, there's been good response locally to a new initiative by Cape Libraries. Tell us about this.
Sure. If you've ever found yourself facing some hefty library late fees because you forgot about that book or DVD that you had borrowed, the Clams Library System, which covers all 35 library systems on the Cape, will now automatically renew those materials up to three times before requiring that you return them. CLAMS director Eileen Chandler told us that a recent software upgrade allowed that change, and all of the libraries in the systems unanimously supported implementing it for the convenience of patrons. And of course, You can still face late fines if you don't return the items after the renewal period is up. And some material like interlibrary loan books and ebooks and other digital materials won't renew automatically. But if you sign up for email or text alerts, it'll let you know when your book or DVD or CD is due, and if it can be renewed, it'll renew it automatically for you.
I've got two kids, and we are intensive library users, and I've noticed this already. It's in the system. It's happening when I would be bringing it to the attention of my children that their books were due. They've already been automatically renewed. It's a nice system.
It's a great thing, and they decided to implement it now rather than wait till the beginning of the year because they thought it was a big convenience for patrons, plus sort of like an early holiday gift for everybody. You know, don't worry about bringing those books back. They're not due yet. And if you need to sign up to get those notifications, you can go to the clamsnet.org website and sign up to get the email or text notifications for renewals.
And it's part of kind of a larger library effort. I know we talked last week about the Oak Bluffs Library doing the same thing. That is Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
State Senator Julian Sear is pushing for legislation to allow an HIV prevention drug to be allowed to be prescribed to minors without parental consent. Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner joins us now to talk about this. Hi, Marianne.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for joining us. Tell us about this drug. It's called Truvada, and tell us what it can do.
Well, right. I believe that there are actually two drugs, and they do allow people who are at risk of contracting HIV infection to take the medicine so that they don't get it. And it's really considered like 99% effective for people who might contract HIV through sexual activity. And even it's like 75% effective through people who might contract HIV through injection. So,
you can imagine how important that could be, right, to
right.
try to stop the TEM. To stem the tide of HIV. And Julian Sear has really taken this up as a cause. He's a state senator, obviously, out of Truro. Tell us what his connection to this is in terms of why he sees this as such an important thing to be advocating.
Well, let's see. I mean, he kind of describes it as something, and actually also with the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod, is the idea that young people, particularly people who might be at risk for HIV infection, would be people who maybe aren't necessarily connected strongly with their parents, yet the law would require parental knowledge or parental consent to get the medicine. So he sees that similar to kind of birth control. That's actually the amendment that he's filed is to amend the state law that allows minors to receive birth control without parental consent. So this would basically augment that.
And he filed this legislation actually last year, and it didn't move forward. He's refiling it this year?
Right. Actually, there are several sponsors in the House and the Senate. It made it through two committees. Then it seemed to die in the Senate Ways and Means Committee. So he filed again in January, and he didn't exactly say why, but he is hoping that it's going to go through. So.
And what can you tell us a little bit more about the outlook for it and what it could mean for the community?
Well, let's see. One of the reasons why we wrote about it now, even though we filed it back in January, is that right down the street from us, where our office is the it's like a drop-in center that the AIDS Support Group of Cape Cod has. And it used to be that they would do infection testing for sexually transmitted diseases in a place that was considered kind of confidential and somewhat hidden, I guess, from the public. But 2 years ago on the World AIDS Day, they just basically opened up this drop-in center and I think they're open year-round, actually. And the request for information, for the medicine, for help with not putting the requests that people have to not be at risk for HIV has really like tripled in terms of, you know, the kind of traffic into this drop-in center. So, yeah, that's why, you know, why I consider it important, or why we as a paper were learning about it more. So
that is Marianne Bragg from the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
On Nantucket, town meeting citizen proposals have proliferated. There are more than 50 of them. Joining us to sift through the offerings, Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, one of these proposals for town meeting is to resurrect a town department that was eliminated almost 10 years ago. And tell us about this.
Sure. A former member of the town's Park and Recreation Commission filed a citizen's petition for the April town meeting that would reestablish the Park and Rec Commission. 9 years ago, it was cut out of the town budget in an effort to save money and reconsolidate some departments following the worldwide economic slowdown of 2008. And for the past 9 years, the town's playing fields and parks have seen plenty of use as the population and the summer population of Nantucket has increased, but they have not been maintained to the level that at least one person, Maria Zoda, who filed the article, believes they should. And what she'd like to do is see the town create a new park and rec department, relatively small one, a department head and at least one staff member to maintain the town's parks and playing fields and schedule the usage of the properties, the game times and practice times. But reestablishing a whole new town department might not be something the town can afford, town manager Libby Gibson said this week. It's hard enough for the town to finance the payroll and find qualified applicants for positions at the Department of Public Works, which absorbed the maintenance side of the park operation when Park and Rec was disbanded. A Park and Rec master plan was also unveiled over the summer, and a recently reappointed Park and Rec commission is reviewing the recommendations in that plan, and there's quite a bit of spending recommended in that plan over the next few years, initially anywhere from almost $15 to $18 million to reduce some of the fields at the Tom Nevers Navy Base, the Nobadir Athletic Complex, and some baseball diamonds in the Mid-Island. So there's some concern among town officials that creating a new department on top of expanding the parks and the improving the parks that the town already has might put too big a burden on on the town budget. But nevertheless, it'll be debated in at town meeting in April, and see where it goes from there.
What else looks like will be debated there at town meeting in April?
Well, quite a bit. Like you said, there's more than these are just the citizens' petitions. There's more than 50 citizens' petitions, and the town, the rest of the town warrant put together by the departments won't even be finalized until January. So it's going to be a lengthy town meeting. That's why we're starting so early to look at some of this stuff. Another article that we looked at this week was one that would prohibit obstructions on private beaches around the island. Blocking off any beach that's privately owned would be prohibited under this article that was filed by Nantucket's Burton Spruce Balkind. He said that he filed it because he was concerned that some no trespassing signs and ropes between the high and low water marks went up on a private beach this summer that people used to be able to traverse, and they couldn't do it anymore. This is a debate that goes goes back centuries, really, and it's a debate that happens in a lot of coastal communities about access to the water and access to beaches and what's public and what's private. Colonial ordinances, most people argue, give the public access to the intertidal zone, which is really the area between the high and low water marks, but a lot of times private property owners have attempted to kind of block that off. Nantucket has long had a tradition of really not blocking that off, of allowing public use of that area of the beach, but sometimes that hasn't been happening, and this article would attempt in some way to prohibit it. Enforcement is another issue that the police department and town officials say might be problematic, but I'm sure it'll get a full and well-discussed debate on town meeting floor.
Hey, before I let you go, briefly, it's Christmas stroll weekend on the island. It's a big deal for people celebrating, but it's also a big deal for businesses.
It really is. It's one of the last, probably the last big business weekend of the year before winter really sets in on Nantucket. The next couple weekends will be busy. We'll still have some visitors, but Stroll Weekend brings in, you know, 10,000 or more visitors to the island. They started coming in. The boats were full yesterday. They're going to be full today. And tomorrow is really the big day. There'll be, you know, about 10,000 people here at least. The restaurants, the hospitality industry in particular, the retail sector, really relies on this to provide one more infusion of cash before they either close down or really sort of hunker down for the winter. Not to mention that it's quite a big celebration. There's lots of entertainment downtown that the Chamber of Commerce puts on. Stores have sales. They have refreshments. There's a big downtown marketplace going on. So it's a fun holiday event. Just a couple weeks before Christmas.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Stickers with hate messages have been appearing on Martha's Vineyard. Three different churches have been defaced with them. George Brennan joins us now from the Martha's Vineyard Times with the story. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, tell us about these stickers. They actually first appeared some little while ago.
Yeah, so this is on three churches, as you said. On all three churches fly the LGBTQ pride flag. That's the rainbow flag that folks are familiar with. And, in each instance, there was a decal that was left behind. And this decal had a phrase from the Bible in it: whatever God calls sin is nothing to be proud of. Just left there. Some of the island clergy started talking about this, and turned out it was happening at various places. So as a group, they decided it was time to go public with this and let the community know that this was happening. They issued a statement this week collectively denouncing this. And they referred to them as hate stickers. At least one instance, it was reported to the police, but in others, it wasn't, inexplicably. But all in the three different towns where this occurred, the police chiefs have launched investigations to see what they can find out. You know, they'd like to know about these when they happen. It makes it easier on investigations, of course. But the bottom line here is that, you know, someone is out there, with these stickers and trying to send a message, and it's not the kind of message that the Vineyard would like.
There is another story that you've got this week that's a more positive message story here. This is about something called Wreaths Across America. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so Wreaths Across America is a really cool program where, it was actually a farm in Maine that has Christmas wreaths as part of its business, and the owner there years ago decided that the Arlington National Cemetery to put some wreaths out at Christmas time for the veterans who are laid to rest there, and it really has caught on across the nation where national cemeteries put out these wreaths at Christmas time, and it's usually done on the second Saturday, I believe, in December, coming up on December 14th. On the island, we don't have a national cemetery, but of course there are veterans who are buried here, and the veterans agent here, Joanne Murphy, she's now the retired veterans agent, about 13 or 14 years ago started the tradition here of putting some out. And that's carried over, and they're going to be doing it again next Friday. And Jack Shea has a pretty good story about the history of that and how they got the Tisbury School involved, which is located very close to the cemetery. And so it becomes a teachable moment for the students there as well. Really cool program and a nice gesture this time of year.
And nice story by Jack Shea.
Yes.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. State lawmakers are on their holiday recess, but that's not stopping work from continuing at the State House on a crucial spending bill that didn't get passed before the House and Senate ended their sessions for the year. WCAI's Catherine Iden spoke about that with our State House reporter, Mike Dean.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
So lawmakers did get a number of bills off their agenda. We talked a lot about that before the holiday. They didn't get to the supplemental spending bill. There's been some talk of that this week because a deadline is looming.
Right. Most lawmakers broke for their holiday recess, which lasts until January. However, the leadership and kind of the top tier people in both the House and the Senate are still around and they're still having meetings because, like you said, they did not finish this supplemental budget bill, which would end budget year 2019. That's the fiscal year that ended this past July. So this is something that they need to legally close the books so that, you know, different kind of accounts can be shifted and reports can be made. It's a very important piece of law legislation that they typically get done without much problems. This year, however, the House and Senate just have not seen eye to eye on getting it done. It's just another example of the House and Senate's kind of increasing distance from one another, where Democratic leaders are, just very, very far apart on a lot of different issues.
It's a lot of money. It's more than $1 billion. And something I didn't quite understand is that municipalities have some funding that they expect from it. On the Cape here, there was talk about different initiatives, everything from funding a mental health court to protecting folks from sharks being tied to this surplus bill. But if it doesn't get passed, those won't get funded, right?
Right. Well, yeah, FY19 was a good year. It resulted in a $1.1 billion surplus. Lawmakers want to spend that surplus. They want to, put it towards programs like you just said. However, the lawmakers really don't pay much heed to their own budget deadlines. However, there's another deadline at play here, and that is the comptroller, Andrew Mailer, who has said that next Wednesday, on the 11th, he will simply take that surplus money and put it into the rainy day account because it's got to go somewhere. The state is not making any interest money off of this account, this principal, that could be in the bank, so to speak. So this is something that either they're going to get it done in the next couple of days or over the weekend, or it's going to be taken out of their hands, which would be remarkable. Senate President Spilka has actually canceled a trip that she was going to take with some other senators to Israel. She's probably going to stay home now to get this done. So they are taking it seriously, but it's several months late.
And State Senator Julian Cyr from Truro was set to go on that trip to Israel as well. And there are some bigger implications if this goes into the rainy day fund, right? I mean, it's one thing to have money in that fund. That's a good thing. But doesn't that affect the state's bond rating if then lawmakers go back and say, oh, can we have that so we can fund all the things we didn't fund?
Right. The bond rating is really based on the health of that rainy day fund. That's something that the ratings agencies had said over the last couple of years, that they wanted to see more money into that fund. So as far as the bond rating is concerned, plumping up the rainy day fund would actually be a benefit. However, if lawmakers then raid that fund to pay for what they intend to use the surplus money for, that's going to be potentially harmful to those ratings agencies. You can't really break the piggy bank.
I want to switch gears now to something else, and that's about vaccinations. There's concerns with the growing number of unvaccinated children here in Massachusetts, and state lawmakers are considering two bills, one that would close a loophole that parents are using, claiming a religious exemption.
There are two main bills that were heard on Beacon Hill this week. One, like you said, was going to eliminate that religious exemption. Basically, right now, there's two ways to exempt a kid from getting the required vaccines. One is that you can have a doctor say that it would be medically harmful to the child. The other one is that you can claim that your religion prohibits that. The problem is, according to the sponsors of this bill, that religious exemption is taken advantage of and has basically become a loophole because there are no major religions practicing in Massachusetts that prohibit vaccination. The biggest group that everyone kind of thinks of, the Christian Scientists, don't actually preach against vaccinations. The other bill would kind of put more strain and tracking and data reporting on those medical exemptions so that the state knows what towns are exempting and what. Right now, the state doesn't really have a great idea of how many medical exemptions there are, which districts and towns are granting them, and where these kids may be.
And it should be noted that
this didn't come without some contentiousness, right? There was a vocal group of people at this hearing. It was a large crowd who opposed new rules like this.
Yeah, there was a packed crowd in the Gardner Auditorium, the largest auditorium here at the State House, with a lot of parents who are skeptics of vaccinations and don't want to see the state regulate this practice more. They were more trying to defeat that reform bill that's from Senator Becca Rausch, the one that would count and crack down on the medical exemptions and things like that. They're arguing that it's taking a choice away from parents and that this isn't the time to do it because nothing has really changed. The counter argument from Senator Rausch and others is that these immunization levels have dropped to the point where we could have some serious public health crises on our hands.
And that is Mike Dean talking to us, as he does most weeks, from Beacon Hill, our State House reporter. Mike, thanks for keeping an eye on things and for your updates.
Great to be with you.
And that is WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with our State House reporter, Mike Dean. This is The Point. I'm Steve Junker. It's the News Roundup. To save a road, do you have to change it? That's the question Falmouth is trying to answer with a project to reimagine Surf Drive, one of its most beloved coastal roads. It's increasingly beset by floods related to sea level rise. WCAI's climate change reporter Eve Zuckoff has been following this story and joins us now. Good morning, Eve.
Morning, Steve.
So last night, the town of Falmouth held its first public meeting bringing residents into this conversation about what's going to happen with Surf Drive. You were there. Tell us about the turnout and what did the residents have to say?
Yeah, so there were 60 people there. I mean, it really got to the point where it was standing room only. And it's really, you can't lose this part of this. A town is considering redesigning a community. They're considering elevating this road, rerouting it, maybe abandoning it. Their line is everything's on the table.
Because it's not really just Surf Drive as a road, but the communities that are contiguous with it.
Exactly. Sea level rise, unfortunately, doesn't end where Walker Street begins, you know. And so that's what people were talking about, though. There was this kind of split in the room. There were people who saying abandonment, rerouting, elevation, all of these things are fine and well to talk about when it's not your home, when your home doesn't hang in the balance. On the other hand, there were people there who are concerned about the environment, and their point of view is we have to be proactive. The water is coming. These homes are in the way. Are we going to get in front of it?
Mm. Back up a little bit here. Give us some context. Why is the town looking at this issue right now?
Yeah, well, you know, anyone who drives down Surf Drive on even a, like, drizzling day knows this road is regularly flooding. The town knows this. Every time it happens, they have to clear sand off the road. They have to repave it. It's costly. You know, so the town hired the Woods Hole Group, this engineering firm, to really figure out what are the projections for this area. 50 years from now, 2070, Surf Drive is projected to experience as much as a 4-foot sea level rise. That, because the area is so low-lying and so flat, as you said earlier, will actually extend all the way to Town Hall. On particularly rainy, stormy days. And we know that because of climate change, coastal storms are getting more intense. They're increasing in their frequency. So the ground floor of Town Hall is underwater in 2070, the way our land looks now.
So this report is trying to wrap its arms around what we can do to start to address this. What and when can we expect to hear what the plan will be for the road?
Yeah, so the funding for this project runs out in June. So the Woods Hole Group has to deliver a report with recommendations to the town by June 30th. That doesn't mean the town will automatically adopt these recommendations, but that is when, you know, we're expecting to see more. But there will be more public meetings. We on our station will continue to follow the story and talk about that. And really the key thing is other communities, Florida in particular, I'm thinking of some, other communities are retreating from their coasts.
Yeah, obviously not just a story about, I mean, this is Surf Drive in Falmouth, but all of our coastal region is going to be facing some of these big questions about how we prepare for this and how we respond as the sea level rise continues and intensifying storms continue.
That's right. We live on a tiny little peninsula and sea level rise is coming, whether we're ready or not. So, you know, it's this question of what are towns going to do? What is our public going to do that they're willing to do to get ready?
WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Steve.
And that's what's been happening around the Cape and Islands this week. I want to thank my guests. We spoke with Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times. We talked with WCAI's Sarah Mises-Tan. We checked in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle and Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and heard from Catherine Ident and Mike Dean at the State House. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.